Hello, everyone. Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. My name is Faiton Snow, and I'm going to be your host today. I'm one of the co-founders of Innovation Bay, along with Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We're a global network of tech founders, investors, and connectors, and our aim is to support founders on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this a long time, since 2003, and we're active with over 5,000 members. Now, if you're interested in connecting, learning, and building relationships with other tech founders and investors, check us out and become a member. You can apply for membership at innovationbay.com. Today, I'm really excited to be talking to Daniel Darling from Darling Ventures. We recorded this on the 18th of September 2020. Now, we're really lucky to have Daniel in the country at the moment because normally he'd be based in San Francisco, but due to COVID, he's currently basing himself back in Sydney. He is originally from Australia, and you probably haven't heard of him before, or Darling Ventures, and there's a very simple reason for that. Darling Ventures was launched in 2014, focused on providing access for Australian investors into early stage opportunities on the west coast of the US. So he didn't come from a venture background, which is really interesting. He came from more of an operator background with a strong focus on sales and marketing and some other things. And he decided he wanted to get into venture. So he read a book, learned what it was all about, and kicked off with a small fund and started providing access into some really interesting opportunities on the west coast. And really networking very hard to build up some great relationships and partnerships that then availed some really interesting opportunities and deals. Fast forward 5-6 years, today he's just recently closed his third fund, which is $30 million, and he's roughly got around 22 investments. We'll discuss all of that today, and his investment thesis, which is all about investing at seed and then preparing those companies for a Series A. It's a really interesting conversation, which is a bit of a focus for us at the moment around angel investing and what it's all about, leading to the launch of our very exciting new Angel Club, which will happen in November of this year. And so the theme that we're kind of discussing over the next couple of months is, what is angel investing? How do you do it? What are the keys to it? And what are some of the experiences of people that have been doing it for a while? So this is a great conversation with Daniel. He's a really interesting guy with a lot of scar tissue and a lot of experience. This is great from the founder side, talking about what he's looking for in the right sort of founders and structure and investment, how early he gets in, what does he need to see in terms of making an investment, what does the due diligence process look like, as well as for our evolving angel community, which is about the risk of investing at seed. What does that look like? How do you get a return? What sort of role does a great investor play over what period of time? There's a lot of great content here. I really enjoyed this chat. Daniel's a really interesting and pretty amazing guy that's done some really special stuff. So let's get into it. Daniel Darling, Darling Ventures. Daniel, welcome on the show. It's great to have you on Open the Pod Bay Doors. And I think it's like a bonus of COVID in some ways that you're kind of stuck in Australia at the moment. So we're able to have you over here. Because normally you'd be in the US, right?
That's right. That's right. Normally I'm in San Francisco, but feeling pretty fortunate to be over in Australia. So thanks for having me on the show.
That's great. So because there's not a lot of content out on you out there, you're a bit of a secretive type individual in the shadows a little bit. I know that's not true just because you spend most of your time in the US. So why don't you give us a bit of a 2 minutes on you?
Yeah, you can bring me back into the light. I'm not trying to be secretive on purpose, but yeah, sure, I'll let you know. So I'm an Aussie who's been working in the California tech industry for the last 10 years now, first as an operator and then launching my own VC firm, Darling Ventures, out of San Francisco back in 2014. And Darling Ventures' mission really is to give Aussie investors access to the very first raise for the next generation of software startups in the States, and to be that investor's sort of trusted long-term partner in Silicon Valley. So that's what I've been up
awesome.
To.
Awesome. And talk about, you've just raised a fund, right? Talk a little bit about that fund size and what your focus is.
Sure. So this is Fund 3. We launched it this year. It's a $30 million pre-seed fund, and it's investing in this next generation software and data startups all throughout North America, the US and Canada. Mm-hmm. And our specialty is to be the very first check into domain expert founders using software and data to transform their industry. We put 250 to 500K to work in our first check and typically lead and focus our value on getting our company to a real rock star Series A.
Awesome. And that money is pretty much all out of Australia, is it? The 30 million?
Yes, it sort of started out with just purely Australian LPs, family offices and individuals. And then now we've started to expand to include some in Europe as well. Okay.
Fantastic. And the current portfolio, what's the size?
We've made 23 investments to date.
Okay, great. And anything that you can talk about that kind of we might know about, or where are they kind of at the moment? Because you've been investing for how many years now?
So this is about 6 years of investing. And so as we're going in right at the early stage, you know, we had some early exits when they were smaller, but really our portfolio is just growing. So they're kind of at the Series B, Series C stage now. Yeah. I'm happy to talk about a few. We've done a bunch in the area called Industry 4.0, sort of the digital transformation of the industrial sector. One called Foghorn Systems. It's an edge computing software for the industrial sector that really turns IoT sensors from simple data collectors into intelligent real-time decision makers.
Gotcha.
That's now a $200 million international company. Serves people like GE, Saudi Aramco, Procter & Gamble, Verizon, Porsche. And we've been helping them also look to get access into some of the mining companies out here in Oz. And so with us backing them, include major corporate partners such as Intel Capital, Bosch, and General Electric.
Yeah, awesome. Fantastic. I'm not sure if you've seen Black AI out of Melbourne yet. Blackbird put some money into them. Really interesting of what they're doing with sensors and AI. I'll send you the details after this. And so tell us a little bit about why you got into venture, because you came from an operations background or an operator background. Is that right?
That's right. I was actually in advertising ad tech in Australia before I moved over. But really, it was an organic journey. So when I moved to the States a decade ago now, I had no idea what venture capital was. Yeah. And my goal was to work for a tech startup, which I ultimately did. And then over time, sort of working in SF, it became clear that there was this real golden age of innovation and we were at this early innings of technology acceleration. So that really took me. And I saw venture as a way to get exposure to the change as a whole. And I liked the idea of working across a portfolio of different tech startups and to look at how the future is through the eyes of these founders. On top of that, it became really apparent to me that Aussies really didn't have a full access or appreciation of the pace of change and the investment opportunities that was happening in the US. And again, this was about 6 years ago. So I saw there was a unique opportunity to build a venture firm that would bridge that access for Aussies into the US and be their man on the ground there.
Gotcha. Okay. And so some of the companies that you worked for in the US, I think you were with Mobile Interactive Group, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Correct. So Mobile Interactive Group, I was part of the founding US team. It was down in LA. And this is back in sort of 2011 when the iPhone moment was coming out. Everyone was looking to transition their enterprise to a mobile-first company. This is mobile sites, mobile apps, mobile advertising, mobile payments. And Mobile Interactive Group was a startup that was really a one-stop shop to help that transition in those early days. And I was looking after all of their sales and marketing and US go-to-market strategy there. And that was a good ride. We rode that to an exit in about 2 years for 60 mil to a company called Velti. Velti is a NASDAQ-listed company over in San Francisco. And that was sort of doing what we were doing just on a much bigger scale.
Awesome. And I think that's how we first got to meet each other, wasn't it? Because I was doing some work or helping out the Fifth Finger guys when they were launching in the US.
That's
and
right.
I think that we sort of bumped across each other at that stage very early on, but you're in LA and I was in San Francisco.
It was a small community back then. I think most people in sort of mobile ad tech sort of knew each other. We were kind of like the pioneers. So that was good. Fifth Finger was a good company.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, so I know that when we were talking before, the focus of the fund is a lot about preparing companies for a Series A. Tell us a little bit about that. How do you do that?
Yeah, so we find a lot of founders, especially the ones that are really technology-driven or product builders, they're confused about what they need to achieve in the seed stage to get to a really strong Series A. We built our firm really to be their first check and partner, help them get strategic about the seed stage and help them understand in a very transparent manner around what they need to achieve, what KPIs, what milestones to get a really strong Series A. And a lot of that is our own information of how we've learned about their industry and sort of what it takes for a startup in that sector to achieve the right KPIs. But also a lot of it is we interface on their behalf with sort of downstream VCs. So these are the Series A firms that they may be targeting. And we communicate very openly at the start of their journey saying, okay, if this company was hitting those right milestones and you were interested in investing as a Series A lead, what would be the KPIs that you'd be looking for? Might be revenue KPIs, customer traction, maybe technology development. And then we back propagate that information to the CEO and the founders saying, okay, let's now build this into the roadmap and the journey of the company, of your seed, so that we can assure that when you get to Series A, that you're really standing, you know, above the rest in terms of how qualified you are for that raise.
Great. That makes a lot of sense. So if we take one step back from that, what do you look for? You know, you talk about you're investing in pre-seed. So maybe just give us a bit of a view of what does a pre-seed company look like?
Pre-seed company is literally the first check. So, you know, I think over in the States and really around the world, the seed stage is professionalized into multi different stages. Yeah. So, but pre-seed is really the first check. They're typically raising anywhere from $500 to $1.5 million. Yeah. The team is the founding team in place. And they have an initial product that's maybe not in market yet, but something that we can start to play around with there. So it's really super early days. It's a lot of focus around that team, around the market vision, and around sort of what it will take to get to that strong Series A.
And what do you, when you look at that and you look at sort of the business, what are you actually investing in? Are you investing in the team or the vision or a mix? What does the mix of those two look like?
I think team's super important at our stage. So we look for founder market fit when we look at the teams, real domain experts who come from the industry that they're disrupting. We feel like it gives them the tangible experience of the pain points being solved, gives them access to customers as their first believers, and also gives them a network to hire from. So that's a really important criteria for us that we put a lot of weight behind those early decisions. But you can appreciate that if you're at pre-seed, there's still so much to be built through so many unknowns out there. The other big part is we look at market. Market's really important. Are they creating a market? Are they competing in one? If so, how crowded is that market and how unique is their innovation and business model to stand apart? What we really love to see is a technology innovation that allows a startup to change the business model on a market, leaving incumbents with sort of little hope.
Gotcha. I mean, it's obviously a high risk stage. How do you mitigate that risk? And there's so many things that can go wrong. How do you look at that?
Yeah, it's high risk because it's so early, but there lies the alpha, right? Getting in on the ground floor can show those massive returns for the minimal amount of investment. What we do, and it's, you know, it's wide in the venture community, you have a portfolio approach to your investment. So in each of our funds, we do 20 plus investments. So we have a way to mitigate the early stage risk by diversifying across the pool of investments to show the ultimate returns of those funds. And then we also mitigate it by not being overly concentrated or weighted into one investment out of those funds. So we have a max 15, maybe 10% amount of fund capital going into any one company. Okay. So that way, when the ultimate failures happen for a lot of the portfolio, it won't take down the entire fund. And that's just sort of around portfolio construction and how you're able to mitigate some of that early stage risk.
And I know that, you know, historically, venture might look at it from a point of view of out of 10 investments, we might lose on 5 or 6, break even on 3 or 4, mm-hmm. and then get hopefully a 10 plus X return on 2 or 3. Is that how you look at it? Or how do you look at the seed?
Yeah, yeah. Or ideally 25, 50, 100 X on sort of 1 or 2, yeah. Right? So I think that still holds very much true. And you know, some people say that if you're not failing at that kind of 50, 60% loss ratio, you may be being too conservative and that you really need to be swinging a bit more for the rafters on those ones. So I think those economics work and you're really looking to make the maximum return off those winners. From our perspective, how we are able to juice the economics for our investors is when we do have a winner out of the fund that looks like it's breaking out, we launch co-investment vehicles to allow for our investors to double down into those investments, typically at the Series A or Series B stage, so they can put more capital to work behind the ones that are looking like the early winners.
Got you. And they do that directly, basically, rather than through you? Because you don't have a follow-on fund, do you, as such?
We don't have a follow-on fund. At the moment, we do it through special purpose vehicles. So we spin up a vehicle that we've managed, and then we help give them access to that deal. Because from the startup's perspective, they're dealing with us, and they are looking at us and saying, okay, we've reserved some follow-on capital for you. And so we're able to take that allocation and provide it back to our investors at later stages via these sort of co-investment vehicles.
Okay, great. There's a bunch of topics that we're going to kind of crisscross here because, you know, it's such an interesting topic for Australia at the moment, given that Australia's angel investing community is starting to really kind of grow and expand. How do you find the difference between your exposure so far to historically how Australians are angel investing compared to maybe the US, which is a much more sophisticated market?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think they're just at different stages of maturity. You know, angels in the US were typically successful founders, and it was done not so much for profit, as they were already individually wealthy by that stage, but for paying it back and supporting their network. So the PayPal Mafia were a case in point in the early days where they were a major catalyst for the Silicon Valley ecosystem, launching companies like LinkedIn to Tesla, et cetera. Yeah. In Oz, I think we're just a little bit earlier on in that journey, but we do have Atlassian and Canva who are giving the ecosystem their PayPal moment, if you will, which I think is incredible to see. And you have Cannon Brooks investing in not just as an angel, but also into funds like Blackbird, et cetera, which grow the whole ecosystem as a whole. So with that, I think there's a big proliferation of opportunities and sophistication of the market in general for angels. But to answer your question more directly, I guess US angels today are far more professionalized these days. So they are big on building personal brands and followership on things like Twitter, on Medium, et cetera. And then they're really strong now at launching syndications on platforms like AngelList to start to compete or invest alongside VCs with much larger checks. So I think it's a real vibrant space. You know, angels in Australia are not wary, but they're sort of watching what's happening in the US and instilling best practices back home, which I think is great.
And it is very different, isn't it, from maybe what historically high net worths or family offices have been investing in, where that's a property deal, which is maybe a very low risk of kind of going completely south, or real estate or something like that.
Yes. No, worlds apart. But then it's first of all, far more exciting than a real estate investment. You know, I think people love talking about what they're investing in innovation in the startup ecosystem. But also venture and angel investing provides a lot more than just the asset class and the capital returns. I think it's an incredible way to stay ahead of what's going on in technology and innovation, and also to understand where the disruption is coming from that maybe impacts your wider asset portfolio on the public markets, et cetera. So I think it offers a lot more, and it just really allows you to network into a really interesting ecosystem of individuals, entrepreneurs, and just keeps your brain really sharp through that. So I think it offers a lot more than a passive investment or a real estate investment would ever will. And also, if you're able to get in on the ground floor of the next big tech company, it can be an absolute life-changing event.
Yeah, we've definitely seen some amazing returns from some of the recent IPOs, and I know there's going to be a lot more in the US and hopefully in Australia over the coming kind of couple of years to provide that kind of liquidity state, because it hasn't really happened in Australia on a significant scale like it has in the US, I guess.
Exactly, and that's kind of what I was talking about with the PayPal moment. You know, we have Atlassian would have provided a lot of liquidity in that sense going public. I think when Canva goes public, that will add some liquidity into the market as well. But for every success, and maybe even the smaller ones as well, it does provide a bit of confidence, a bit of liquidity, a bit of a track record into the ecosystem. Yeah. And now it's sort of laying out a bit of a path to say, okay, there's a real reason why I should be angel investing, or there's a real reason why I should be concentrating you know, part of my time to investing in technology startups.
Yeah. Okay, makes total sense. So, you know, I think I've talked to you about we're launching an angel network, which is a little bit different. It's more around a membership-based kind of club focus, where we're still, you know, very founder-orientated. But we do want to bring in family offices and high net worths that maybe have historically not invested in tech. What advice, you know, would you give them if they're starting to look about diversifying their portfolio and starting to invest in tech?
Yeah, so I think being part of angel networks is a really good idea. Often it can be quite a lonely endeavor and you're not really sure if what you're seeing is truly unique or how many other deals are out there if you're just casually doing it on the side. So being part of a network of other experts, sharing deal flow, sharing diligence responsibilities, investing as a syndicate is a great way to get started and really just to exercise that mental muscle of how you do angel investing. And so, you know, you might start small, put your toe in the water with smaller checks. My advice would be focus initially on industries that you know. Maybe you've had your career in a certain industry like the telco industry, et cetera, and you're like, okay, this is a part that I know well. I maybe have some value to bring to these companies when I'm chatting to the founders. And so that's a great place to start initially investing and to build up a bit of a reputation and a brand around there. But I think the only way to really understand it is to get involved and to get started.
Yeah, fair enough. Great. You just got to dabble a toe, don't you? Just step into it. And I think that's great advice about focusing on an industry that makes sense to you that you kind of come from and then working with other people to sort of educate and build up a knowledge base over time. Because it is hard to work out what's real and what's not sometimes.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the big benefits that we have as VCs is we see a huge amount of deals. So to give you an idea, this year we're on track to see about 3,000 US startups. And so that amount of companies allows you to understand what the market as a whole is doing in terms of innovation. It allows you to see what that specific opportunity that you're gravitating towards, how it fits into the competitive landscape, what other entrepreneurs are doing, what other firms are thinking of in terms of how they're positioning their companies to disrupt that industry. So that's a really important part that is not really offered to individuals who are just approaching one deal on a casual basis. And so I think that that's something that benefits when you start to syndicate, when you club together, you can start to form this bit of a macro understanding of that environment to help inform your decision making on which deal you should go after and which you should leave.
Yeah, awesome. So I want to just throw something else at you in terms of we do hear a little bit about, you know, supply demand on deal side and how there's a, I'm not sure if you're seeing this or not, or think about this, about there's always the really great deals are all always oversubscribed. They're always really hard to get into. What we're seeing, I guess, is we're seeing a plethora of opportunities kind of in Australia at the moment. You know, we sort of estimate there's around 5,000 plus seed stage deals. How do you start to distinguish between what's a great deal and what's not? Is it kind of based upon your expertise and what you can bring to the table, or is it based upon the actual business itself or the company itself?
Yeah, it's a lot of those factors that you point out. So, you know, the best deals coming from seasoned founders, repeat founders, they'll always have a flood of interest and be oversubscribed and you know, fought over. But that again, there's lots of first-time founders or diamonds in the rough that come out all the time that are accessible to angels from that perspective. So discovering how that is a really strong investment opportunity. It could come from your expertise of that specific industry. So, you know, that goes back to the recommendation of if you have an understanding of a certain industry sector or a certain market or can club together with some people who complement your thinking in that area, then you have a much better chance of diligencing and assessing that opportunity. You'll start to see more deal flow from that market as people recognize you as an investor in that space. And then you can build some expertise around what is happening in that area, what investments you want to back. So that's a really good place to start, is to start with that initial focus. Another thing that we approach at the early stage and the pre-seed, we're very collaborative at our stage. So at the Series A and Series B, it's a very competitive environment. you can appreciate that there's so much money being raised by these US funds, or even in Australia now, with the $500 million Blackbird funds, et cetera. There's a lot of money going after the Series A's and the later stages. And that's a very competitive environment, because these funds have to take the entire round, the 20% allocation of that right. round. But what you can take advantage of at the pre-seed and angel stage is typically they're inviting, you know, two, three investors into the mix, and maybe some smaller checks to follow that. So by working with other firms or working with other angels and saying, okay, here's a good deal, I think it's a really interesting space, I've diligenced in this way, would you like to enter it with diligence and share your expertise on it too? Open it up to your network and see what experts you can bring into diligence. So approaching it in a very collaborative way is something that works really well for us and for other firms. So that's something that really helps in gaining confidence and conviction around investment opportunity, rather than just looking in isolation okay. From your own perspective.
And is that because, you know, they're obviously, by the time they get to an A or a B, the natural funnel of selection has kind of edited out, so there's just not the volume of deals, in essence?
There's that. There's a natural choke point for sure. Yep. But also the writing's a bit on the wall. So at the angel and pre-seed, you know, it could just be the founders pitching it with their initial prototype and product. There's so much unknowns out there. At the Series A, for example, they could be north of a million or even 2 million ARR. They could have their customers in place, their initial teams in place. You can start to see how things are developing out. And because now the seed stage, so much capital is being raised, you know, some companies have raised $5 to $10 million by the time they've even got to a Series A. There's a lot that's proven out. There's a lot that's gone into that company. And now with these later stage funds who have, you know, a billion plus under management, they're happy to sit back and just pay up for that company right. based on how well they're doing and the tractions, and just really cherry pick the best that the seed is delivering to them.
So on a seed round raising, say a million, how many investors do you normally find are participating in that?
It can vary. You can have ones where it's super syndicated and everyone's just dipped their toe in the water with 50, 100K checks. Yeah. We would think that that would be a very weak round, because no one's really stepped up and said, okay, this is the, you know, this is my company. I'm going to take responsibility and I have high conviction. Yeah. But what we like to see is we like to see a strong lead or two co-leads into that deal that take at least 50% of the round, if not more, around the, you know, 60 to 80% of the round. And then you can have these kind of smaller checks involved, because we feel that then these lead investors, they're dedicating their resources, their time, they've got this high conviction where they're putting a significant amount of their fund into that company, versus potentially a large fund or a collection of large funds who sound great, they have these big reputations and brand names, but they're only putting in small checks as kind of a placeholder to see if they develop out, then they might get interested in helping out the company, or might get interested in sort of participating in a stronger way.
Gotcha. How important is the investor in a seed round? Like what sort of impact do you think the investor makes outside of capital?
Oh yeah, it's key. And it's key is what everyone competes on. So it's really about the seed round, and your first raise is all about finding the right partner. There's so much to be discovered. There's so much to be figured out along the way to find that kind of product market fit, to find that fit in the market of the company, that you really need to find the right partner who can help you navigate that. And so it's a lot more than capital. You know, capital will be the lifeblood for you to be able to get started, to get your 18 to 24 month runway that's necessary to execute. But having both the strategic insights from the right partner, the networks from that partner to help accelerate your business is super key through that mix. So it's a massive factor.
Yeah, awesome. And so I just want to go back, because you know, we talked a little bit at the start of the podcast about how you prepare companies with a set of metrics to raise a Series A. What generally are they? What do you need to be doing at a seed to get to that Series A stage?
It's depending on what industry. So we focus largely on B2B software companies. Typically, what we're looking for, what people are looking for at the Series A, are some levels of indication of product market fit. And that's a pretty loaded term, but if we had to break it down in general, the standard metric is around 1.5 million ARR in revenue. But it's important to understand that that's just a indicator of what would be seen as customer traction, customer adoption. So not all revenue is treated equally. So if all of that revenue has come from one large customer, for example, that won't be seen as favorably as, for example, it coming from 10 customers, because it's shown that you have a sales process in place. It's shown you've got some repeatability in your model. You've got some wider adoption and a clearer path to scale versus everything concentrated on one juicy customer. It shows that you haven't necessarily replicated what you're doing multiple times. The key to think about Series A is basically a time where you've initially figured out your value proposition, your product, and your fit in the market. And the Series A is the first raise where they're going to pour some fuel on the fire and really put some fuel behind your growth into that market.
Gotcha. Okay. And that's an interesting one in terms of like product. Do you normally find, because I'm sure in the US, like 1.5 million of ARR is probably not a lot, right? Given the size of the customer base in the US. So it would still be fairly early. Are you looking for customer feedback, customer engagement, repeat customers? How important are those sort of things? And then how do you flip that back into where the product sits? Because I'm assuming that the product's constantly evolving anyway.
Yeah. And so I think if you can show some repeatability, or, you know, maybe it's same account growth, yep, that's fantastic. So maybe you've got your first little beachhead into a large customer, maybe it's with one team or a certain amount of user bases. And not only has that worked out for you, but it's also grown in value. That's a great indication back to investors. So if you're able to show not only we have 10 customers, but five of them have either re-upped their license or expanded their license, yeah, then that's a really strong indicator of stickiness, of fit, and that it's really showing some value to the end customer, because ultimately you're trying to prove out that your product matters to the market, that they're seeing value in it, that they wanted to pay for it, and you have the right process in place to deliver it out to that market.
Yeah, okay. And what about the team? How big does the normal team get to that point? What does the team look like in general?
Yeah, so I think the team is still pretty lean. You know, it's definitely evolved from the founders and their initial, three or four people that have joined them. You're probably looking anywhere from 10 to 30 people at that stage when you're going to a Series A. You've probably started to staff both engineering and sales, your first salespeople, and also starting to layer on some people like customer success, account management, and maybe even your first marketing hired itself in a wider way.
Okay. In Australia, we tend to see, historically, we've seen early stage companies pushed to build a sales function really early on, rather than that kind of, I've noticed in the US, it's much more a focus around engineering and product and building something that has long-term scalability. How do you see the delta between those two?
Yeah, great question. So I think at the start, at the early journey, we really like to see focus on product, because the product should be the one that the customers are seeing value in and wanting to get that early adoption with. And the CEO should be the one that's selling that product in the very early stages. And what we're looking for is really product-led growth, where customers are turning to that company to adopt that product. They see the value, and that's really the selling point. Once you start to develop out the product to a point where it is proving value amongst your initial cohort of customers, then that's a really good time to hire up additional salespeople to put behind that product and say, okay, we've proven out potentially after a couple of mini pivots or different product focuses and value propositions and pricing models, we've proven out that this is the right vertical for us. This is the right business model. We've got our first one or two referenceable customers. Let's put behind a salesperson who has the networks in place to then call up his networks, start pushing the product out wider and start to try and add more customers to that set. But I think prematurely to do that, salespeople typically want to have a little bit more in place rather than go through this kind of discovery product iteration cycle alongside the founders. So I think putting salespeople in place too early is premature, it adds cost to the business, and really we look to the founding team and the CEO to be that first salesperson for the company.
Gotcha. You know, obviously when you're a founder at that early stage, you're multitasking. You're doing a little bit of HR and recruiting and sales and product. And mm-hmm. how do you provide consultation, advice, direction to your portfolio around how they manage that?
Look, I think every founder is completely pressed for time and wearing multiple hats at the start. What we do is for every single deal that we invest in, we're a two-partner firm and both partners work on that deal.
Right.
So we do provide a lot of bandwidth of how we can support the CEO in their roles, and we aren't afraid to roll up our hand and do nitty-gritty tasks like building out sales material decks, etc. We also have an advisory board that we like to deploy on behalf of our founders, and these are functional experts who are real specialists in certain areas. So, for example, if we're looking at discussing pricing and business model strategies with the CEO, we have the head of pricing at Stripe, the $34 billion fintech company over in the States, and they can have a really meaningful and strategic, you know, one, two meetings with the CEO to help them flesh that out. Or if someone's looking at, okay, how are we going to do an advertising campaign or programmatic advertising, we have one of the exited CEOs of one of our ad tech companies who's an advisor who can come in and have that discussion with them. And really what we're looking to do is to accelerate the decision-making process or the arrival to the decision that the CEOs are doing by putting in place experts who have a much longer understanding of that industry or that sort of function that they're looking at.
How do you compensate them for that?
Good question. So we give them a percentage of the carry of the fund.
Awesome.
So if we want them to be really aligned to the success of our companies and really motivated to want to help our company. So if that company does well, then the portfolio does well. Portfolio does well, we receive profits as a firm, and then they get a share of those profits.
What a great way to do it. That's it.
We think so.
Yeah. And is it hard to get those people engaged?
Look, I think that's the beauty of being in the Valley. And Faden, you would have experienced this when you're over there. There's such a notion of and a culture of wanting to contribute to the ecosystem, wanting to pay it back.
Yeah.
All these people have been successful in their own careers and individual careers, but they're also incredibly generous with their time to the ecosystem, to mentoring, to being advisors, to helping out, even to angel investing. So we find that it's a really vibrant space to be able to tap into experts and networks and build relationships there. And we've sort of been very strategic around which ones we wanted to have as part of our advisory board to join the firm and how we'd be deploying them with our companies. Obviously, these people are incredibly busy with their own careers. And so you just have to be very respectful around, you know, how you schedule meetings and how you sort of allocate their time.
Yeah, awesome. And do you normally take a board seat when you do invest in the companies? Or how does that work for you guys?
At the very early stage, we typically don't. We typically take a board observer seat so we can ride along on the board and have access to all the right information and reporting and be alongside the founder as the sounding board. But we typically don't take the board seat at the pre-seed level. And it's unusual to see a board formalized at such an early stage. Typically, it's around the seed and definitely at the Series A boards are formalized.
Gotcha. Okay, so we're running a session in a couple of weeks on boards on one of our normal Wednesday morning sort of sessions. And it's super interesting in Australia because there's a lot of discussion around it. Like, how early should you have a board? What's the difference between an advisory board and a board? And then what's the role of a board? So why don't we just jump into those and say, you know, what do you think? What's the difference between an advisory board and a board for an early stage founder?
Big difference. So I've been a member of 5 boards, and I tell you, being a member of the board is a lot more work and a lot more of a commitment than being an advisor or just being an investor. You're almost taking on an operational role within the company, and you have a lot more responsibility with that company. So anyone joining a board should take it in full seriousness and be eyes wide open to the amount of effort and work that that entails versus then just being a passive investor. So it's not an opportunity for someone who would like to be an investor in the company, but maybe have a bit more oversight or control. They really need to be prepared to roll up their sleeves and work alongside on a monthly basis with that CEO and tussle with the big problems and the small problems alongside them. Advisors are much more strategic in sort of when they get actioned into a company. So they're more sitting on the sidelines and getting tapped by the CEO when there's something specific that they need guidance on. Maybe they're a specific industry expert. Maybe they have a unique functional expertise. And the CEO will reach out and be like, can you please give me some guidance or some strategic inputs or some introductions in that space? So that's more of a use them as they needed basis. An investor can form both of those functions, or it can be a completely passive role if you're able to communicate that up front with the founder.
Gotcha. A lot of first-time founders, they're learning a lot of sort of stuff. They're making mistakes. They're picking themselves up. You know, it's not an easy journey at the best of times. What do you think the key role of an investor at that seed stage should be?
We have to wear multiple hats, just like the founders have to wear multiple hats. But at the end of the day, we're along for their journey. So I think a lot of it is around being as supportive as possible. What we like to do is we like to support and wrap around our founders a sense of clarity and direction around where they're going or what they're ultimately striving for in that Series A period, and be really strategic about developing out roadmaps, financial plans, go-to-market strategy. So things become really clear, really upfront, putting forward that sort of strategic insight so they can just switch into an execution mode. So I think that's a really valuable way to partner with founders early on, is to spend the time upfront laying out the plan to succeed on their vision, break it into those milestones, and then allowing them to slip into that execution mode.
Gotcha. Okay. And then on an ongoing basis, how do you manage the kind of, you know, watching potential mistakes being made, but appreciating the fact that you're going to learn a lot from making mistakes than you are from not seeing or being averted from making those mistakes, but obviously not wanting the business to fail?
That's a great question. So there's going to be countless mistakes along the way. And the founders will be learning from lots of little ones that as an investor, you don't get to see. You know, there is a natural way where they want to sort of have those mistakes in private and then bring you some of the bigger updates from there. So even if you think you're not being exposed to that many, I'm sure there's a lot behind the scenes that they're learning from there. But I think what's key is to establish a dialogue of real open transparency and trust. And that's something that we look to do in the diligence phase, not until not until after the investment and saying, okay, that's when we're going to start to see what's wrong with this business or what we need to work on with this business. You need to be very open and transparent throughout the whole process to get to the heart of what are the challenges that the founder is tussling with to achieve the ultimate goal of the business. And one key way of opening up that transparency is to also be very honest about what you know as an investor and what you don't know as an investor. You know, your areas of expertise, where you're strong, where you're weak, what you understand about their business, what you don't. And I think if you show vulnerability on your side and openness to learn and to say, I don't know certain areas, then they will do the same. And that will just become a much more productive dialogue and a productive working relationship. Because what you don't want is to have meetings and updates where they're looking to present the best picture to you all the time. You want to be as close to the reality as possible and as close to that productive working partnership as possible.
That's great. We had Tom Humphries on the podcast a little while ago, another awesome Aussie in the US.
He's a good man.
And he was talking about the time frame of how long it took him to feel comfortable, and also the founders, for them to do a transaction, to do a deal. And one of the first deals I think he did was it took him about a year. How long do you start that dialogue off for? A lot of founders sort of think, you know, I'm going to pitch, you're going to love the pitch, and then you're going to invest money and it's going to take a month. What do you think is the due diligence cycle normally?
Yeah, and you know, Access is who Tom works for is typically a Series A or a later stage firm, so it's a little bit different versus at our stage at the pre-seed. We take on a little bit more risk. But we've had deals in the current portfolio. We've known the team for 6 months, and we've had ones where we've written a check within two. Right. I think what happens is the source of the deal is really important to this equation. Okay. So if it is a really nice referral from either a previous founder who has known the entrepreneur well and is referring to you the deal, then that's something that you can start to have some pretty strong conviction around. If it's a co-investor of yours who you've done multiple deals with, who understand what you like to invest in, how you work, et cetera, and they're bringing a deal that they're investing in, that can help speed things up in terms of understanding that relationship. You know, I think everyone would love to spend a countless amount of time getting to know a team, a founder. I'm sure they feel the same way about getting to know their investors as well, but we're often not afforded that time constraint in there. I would say that we typically wouldn't do a deal where we had to do it within, let's say, 2 weeks from start to finish, okay. But we could get close to that.
Because then how do you build that kind of rapport with a founder? You know, how many times do you meet with them? Do you think, how many times do they normally pitch to you? What's your process before, say it's someone that hasn't been referred to you or someone that's new that you've identified? Talk to us a little bit about that process.
Yeah. So typically, you know, let's say an inbound deal comes in that resonates. It's a thoughtful email. It's targeted to our firm, to what we invest in. It's clearly someone who's done their research in us and thinks that we're a good partner. We typically request their investment deck so we can qualify that as an opportunity of interest. Then we set up a 30 to 45 minute call with one of the partners to unpack a little bit more to see if it's an opportunity that we would want to seriously consider. Following that, we then invite them to a 1 hour session with both partners where we start to unpack the opportunity in more detail. And at that point, we'll give the decision to the founder that we're either going to move into due diligence or it's not a right opportunity for us. After that due diligence, once we've decided to move into due diligence, we then look at our network. And this goes back to the collaborative nature of how we want to approach things. So we look at our network and we go, okay, who would be a really strong complementary co-investor who we could bring in maybe with a specific expertise in that area that can help us in this diligence phase, that we can work on this deal and ultimately be the two co-leads, for example, of this opportunity for a really strong outcome. Then we look at our advisory board and our wider network and say, who are the experts in this technology? Who are the experts in this industry? How can we validate the opportunity from that point? And we start making introductions to the team for those conversations as well. Through that process, if we gain further conviction, that's a real strong opportunity. We write an investment memo. The investment memo is a 16-page document outlining the whole opportunity. We then take it to our investment committee, which are three seasoned money managers we have great respect for, run it past them. They spar back and forth with us on the opportunity, and then we ultimately decide to invest or not.
Well, okay. That seems like a pretty streamlined process, not too long.
It's not too long. We can do it very quickly, but it was important to get in place.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we've become incredibly efficient around how we do it, and that's just practice and time. But it's also important to have a process in place to understand how you're going to think about it, trying to check your biases, all these different elements in there to get to that right decision.
What about founder mindset? So I'm sure there's, you know, you get 1,000 different founders pitching to you all the time. What's the commonality, or what are the things that you look for in a founder's mindset when they pitch to you, how they think about the business that gets you excited?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we do look for this domain expertise and founder market fit. So I think we want to see in a founder a real reason why they're the right entrepreneur for the job. We don't want to see someone who's come in and thought, okay, this is a really exciting space that is blowing up at the moment. I don't really have any expertise there, but it sounds cool to do a startup in that space. That doesn't give us the right conviction that they have the expertise to take on that space, or the conviction to that they will stick around and see it through no matter what turns the company takes. Yeah. So we really want to see that sort of expertise and the reason for that founder going after that problem and that long-term mission of what they're wanting to solve. Next is we want to see a level of ability to work with us, ability to be transparent around what's going on, strong ability to execute. So we track the metrics that they convey to us in the first meetings, look at the short-term milestones of theirs, and over the course of our diligence, just check in on how they're progressing. You know, it's fine to miss milestones, every startup does, but having a good reason, a good dialogue back and forth of why that is a really good indication in diligence. And if they're over-executing and every time we check in, they're exceeding their milestones, and that's a really strong indicator that these guys are strong executors and that we want to be involved. So I think that that's important there. And then the other one would just be about sort of a cultural fit and the value alignment. We're, after all, very long-term partners for these companies. If we're investing in the startup right at the start of the stage, this could be a 10, 15-year journey that we're embarking on if it becomes a really big success. So ensuring that we have that right value alignment, that we have a good working relationship, that we're people we can trust with high integrity, is important to us to embark on that.
I feel like sometimes in Australia, you know, we don't have the belief that we can really kind of create the next Atlassian or Canva or Safety Culture or CultureAmp type companies. And so as a consequence, we talk about, we don't have that kind of, we're going to create a $1 billion company or a $100 million company. We're going to build something, then we'll sell it. And, you know, how do you look at that? And I guess that's very different to the US and probably what you're seeing over there.
I think that's right. And I think that will change. Like you just mentioned some fantastic successes, and every single time there's a big local success, what's possible changes. The scale and size of Atlassian is incredible and can give everyone a North Star of how big something can be born out of Australia. But it's right. I think people in the US, they are in a much bigger market, but they are playing a much bigger game as well. They're always thinking about what could be the big outcome for their company, not necessarily what would be the smaller acquisition. That's not a bad strategy. There could be fantastic business to be made by an entrepreneur to say, okay, this is a really good product that maybe an Atlassian would find really attractive and could buy within the first 2-3 years if I'm successful in building out that product. It won't be a life-changing event in terms of an outcome, but it'll be a really fantastic event for Should investors. So not every single investment has to be that $1 billion moonshot. Yeah. There can be some good businesses that are made in there, but it definitely is the American mindset to go big or go home in that way, versus what's happening in Australia.
And do you think that's how important is that? Because sometimes I think, you know, when founders here talk about, I'm going to, you know, take over the world, investors can be very skeptical about them. They can kind of think they're a little bit on the BS side.
Yeah.
You know, how do you?
Yeah. Now, look, that's a cultural thing. That's a cultural thing. I completely appreciate how people would think there. And, you know, there's a skepticism. There's skepticism around, you know, is that possible? You know, why you? Why from Australia? Can an Australian do it? And again, over time, that will be proven that yes, we can, and yes, we will. The mentality in America is just a bit more, you know, go-getter, a bit more out there than people in Australia. We still sort of have that tall poppy syndrome that we're sort of shaking off slowly. So, you know, going out there and saying, I'm going to take over the world, is not necessarily something that resonates in the local market. Versus in the US, if you think too small, you might be seen as not ambitious enough, not having enough conviction, and those things can work against you from there. But overall, people in the US have really made an art form of selling themselves, of selling the vision, of selling the big, bold outcome that they're going for. And that's just a skill that's been instilled over there in the economy, which is very impressive and helps to achieve that goal of going for these billion-dollar outcomes.
I think you've got to have a big aspiration, don't you? It's such a hard journey and there's so many things can happen. If you're not aspirational, then it can be pretty tricky.
Yeah, you know, you want to play for something big, yeah. Right? If you're going to put all of your life's effort and this is going to be your life's work, and I think that's something that we like to see is you want to see that this is the company for them. This is what they really want to put everything behind. This is not just an interesting project for them to do for a couple of years and hopefully get an outcome with. You know, people who are real mission-driven, who really want to put everything behind it, are the entrepreneurs you want to back. And I think that if you're going to put everything behind it, you want to play for something big. You want to play for something meaningful, something transformative to that industry.
Awesome. I mean, Daniel, we can keep talking for hours. We've got to wrap up, unfortunately, in a minute. A couple of things I just wanted to close on before we go into our quick fire questions. What does 2021 look like for you? Where's the business going? And tell us, you know, what the next couple of years are going to be like for you.
I wish I had that crystal ball, given what's happening in this current situation. Look, we have our new fund. We're really excited about deploying into, we've done 3 investments, since closing this fund. We're excited to do another, at least 17 investments over the next couple of years. Very optimistic around how this massive accelerating pace of technology, especially given the COVID situation and, you know, basically what was a 5-year jump in technology adoption, what that means for the startup ecosystem, for disruption, for innovation. I think it's an incredibly exciting time to be investing globally and certainly in the US. So we're going to be very excited about investing over the next couple of years. Our journey is around helping Australians and now more international investors really understand what is happening over in Silicon Valley and America as a whole and being that bridge of access into these companies. So there's a lot that we want to achieve out there. There's a lot around building reputation, increasing our access, increasing our network that we're looking at. I think for us, what's been interesting this year is we really looked outside of just the Valley. We've done a big push around investing and building our networks in other ecosystems as the world kind of moves a little bit more virtual and a little bit more distributed. So we've been spending time in New York, in Boston, in Toronto, in Austin, in Seattle. We've done investments in LA of late. And it's really interesting to see how these other innovation ecosystems within North America are popping up to complement what's happening in the Valley. So I think you'll see us focusing a lot more around those areas going forward.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's jump into the quick fire questions. Now, favorite book at the moment?
Atlas Shrugged, I'm rereading by Ayn Rand.
Awesome. And why?
Oh, the journey there is incredible. I think the characters are incredibly rich and sort of the vision of sort of all of these sort of amazing minds and entrepreneurs getting together and creating, you know, their own little world is something that I naturally gravitate to.
Awesome. Favorite podcast, if you have one?
Yeah, Patrick O'Shaughnessy does a fantastic podcast called Invest Like the Best.
Okay.
And interviewing, you know, top investors and really seeing the world through their eyes.
And it's called Investors. Sorry, I missed that.
Invest like the best.
All right, sounds great. What about news source? Where do you gather that from?
Lots of spots, but the information is a really good source. If you're looking for what's happening out of the US, they have great exclusive access into emerging stories in the tech scene.
I love it. I use it. It's fantastic. This is one of my favorite ones. What about best holiday location or destination?
Yeah, I'm a water guy. So Southern Lao Group in Fiji is definitely my top choice.
Okay, there. Fantastic. Is there a favorite founder or CEO that you look to?
I've been a fanboy for 10 years now of Bezos, so I'd have to put him forward.
Amazing, isn't it? And what about productivity tools? Is there something that you use that you live by?
Yeah, I sort of live in Microsoft To-Do List.
Really?
Very list-orientated process guy, yeah.
I haven't heard that one for a while. What about if you're going to...
They bought Wunderlist, which was where I was before, the startup, and rolled it into Microsoft To-Do.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, cool. Hey, and what about if you're going to do a TED Talk on anything, what would you do a TED Talk on?
I've got to say underwater archaeology, even though I have absolutely no expertise there, it was been the dream job of mine since I was a kid. So I'd love to get up on stage and try to do something around
that.
Are
you a diver? You must be.
I am. Yeah. Love it.
To get you down to Tassie. There's a few good wrecks down here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'll bring my thick wetsuit to get down.
Hey, Daniel, it's been so great to have you on the show, and it's really exciting what you're doing in terms of just providing Aussies access to such an interesting market and obviously great returns from the success you've had on your third fund. So congratulations.
Thanks, Faden. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, and exciting to see what you're up to at Innovation Bay as well. And thanks to all the listeners as well.
Yeah, awesome. Good luck in the future.
All right. Take care.